Matt Taibbi is often referred to as the next Hunter Thompson. Taibbi is a contributing editor for Rolling Stone magazine and covers national politics. He's known for his outrageous antics, such as covering the John Kerry campaign in a gorilla costume, working undercover as a Bush-Cheney campaign volunteer, and interviewing a former drug czar while tripping on acid. Since we're talking about audacity this hour, Anne Strangechamps thought she'd better sit down with Matt and get his perspective.
I have to say, reading your columns and then listening to the candidates speak, there seems to be this sort of disconnect. The world of politics, as you describe it, is this seamy, corrupt world in which corporate capitalism and government bureaucracy have kind of strangled every last decent impulse. And then you hear the guys on the campaign trail talking about hope and change and doing good. Is that even possible anymore?
Well, when they're talking about hope and change, and I'm going to make a list because they have a list, you know, there are a bunch of words that they intentionally try to insert into their speeches as many times as possible. Like values is another one, strength, security. And they find these words by using dial surveys with focus groups where they get a bunch of people to listen to speeches, and they turn dials to one side when they like what they're hearing, and they turn them to the other side when they don't like what they're hearing. And what they get out of those surveys is people like to hear words like change, they like to hear words like values, they like to hear words like hope. And so you get those words inserted into the speeches so many times. I mean, in the last week in Iowa, the Des Moines Register, they were actually counting, and they caught Obama used the word change 23 times in one of his last speeches, and Hillary used it 17 times in a speech just an hour later. So,
you know, as a voter, this just sort of makes me think, how dumb do they think we are? And then I look around and I think,
we are dumb.
I guess we are that dumb.
Right. That's the problem. The problem is you want to blame these people for doing this stuff, and it's incredibly calculating and insulting. You know, if you look at it from an objective point of view, you're talking about, you know, these are U.S. senators, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. They've been sitting in, you know, these important committee meetings for years. They know more about how the world works than, you know, 99.9% of us. And yet they don't tell us anything that we don't know when we get them. Then they give these speeches. They just tell us what they know, what we want to hear. And it turns out that what we want to hear isn't even all that interesting. It's just a bunch of focus group words. You know, whose fault is that? I mean, I think on some level it's got to be our fault and not entirely theirs.
So we've been talking about political audaciousness in this hour. Is there anything about the state of politics today, I mean, how far, in particular, how far electoral politics have come, that makes you think this is all audacious?
Well, give you an example of audacity. Last week in the debates, Mitt Romney claimed that he didn't know that he was describing John McCain's immigration policies as an amnesty, that the ads that had been put out that said that had been done entirely by subordinates and that he didn't know that. And yet he's in that commercial saying, I'm Mitt Romney and I approve this ad. you know? So, I mean, that's audacious. I mean, the thing is, these politicians are smart enough to know that if they lie and the lie is bold enough, they can get away with it. The important thing is that the public's, you know, collective memory is extremely short and the news cycle is even shorter. So, you know, it's important for them to win the moment and not to win the truth-telling game. And so they know they can get away with saying pretty much anything, and it doesn't matter. Even in the journalists, even if we want to correct them, we're going to be correcting them on page 4 or page 8 and not on page 1. So that allows them to do things that are audacious just in terms of, you know, bending the truth.
Hmm. Let's talk some about some of the low points along the path to the blatant political lie. You've covered a lot of them over the last several years. Tell us about a guy you found named Ernest Robbins.
Ernest Robbins was an executive at a company called Parsons. And Parsons was a company that had won a significant amount of contracts involving reconstruction in Iraq. Ernest Robbins used to be a big officer in the Navy. And he just followed the typical career path of a Pentagon official. He worked in the procurement office for a long, long time in the Pentagon. And then when he retired, he went straight to the private sector where he, you know, kept all of his old connections. And instead of doling out multi-billion contracts, he was receiving multi-billion dollar contracts. In his case, Parsons had quite a lot of really, really lucrative contracts in Iraq, including one to build the Baghdad Police College, where they spent, I think it was over $130 million over a course of a couple of years to build a facility that was supposed to house something a little over 3,000 police recruits. And they ended up not getting a single functioning building and not getting any of the recruits through the academy because the entire project was a failure. But not only
worse than a failure, you describe it rather graphically in your book as being literally
right.
a pile of
yeah. I mean, what happened was when the auditors finally went to the college to look at the results of this construction, they found that there were. Because the plumbing had been done incorrectly, the rooms were actually caked in human feces and urine and therefore were unusable. So, I mean, we literally got a pile of, I think you can
fill in the blank.
Insert the word yourself there, but and for $150 million or whatever it was. And, not only were they not reprimanded by the government, they were actually given the maximum amount of a bonus under their cost-plus agreement.
Wait, they were given a bonus?
Yeah, they have what's called a cost-plus contract, and the cost-plus is what that is when the government doesn't want to assign a specific figure that they're going to dole out for a contract. They just tell contractors, look, you're going to spend as much as you want to spend, and you tell us at the end how much you've spent, and then we'll give you your profit margin in terms of a percentage on top of that. Typically, that's something like 7% or 5.5%, but with the Parsons contract, it was basically done by degrees. If they were to do a really good job, they were going to get a higher percentage. And if they were to do, only a merely satisfactory job, they were going to get another percentage. But they got the maximum amount of profit percentage for that job, despite the fact that it was not only not usable, but a total disgrace and, a public health hazard and all of that.
Did they get off scot-free, or were there were hearings on this, weren't there?
There were hearings, but they got off scot-free. I mean, the Bush administration hasn't joined in a single fraud suit against any Iraq contractor to date.
Is that exceptional, or is that par for the course in Iraq?
No, that's not even close to exceptional. That's absolutely par for the course. I mean, the experience with Parsons was absolutely normal for what happens in Iraq. I mean, there are not only hundreds, there are thousands of instances of companies getting involved in taking these enormous contracts and not delivering. I mean, you had a subsidiary of Halliburton making deliveries of phantom deliveries of, across the desert. Basically, what they did is they would send a bunch of trucks back and forth across the desert and then charge the government for delivering cargo when there was, in fact, no cargo.
Wait, the trucks were empty?
They were empty, yeah. So they actually risked the lives of these civilian contractors just to run back and forth across the desert and so they could bill the government for it.
Just so they could run up the bill?
Yeah, exactly. And to show you what they thought of us, I mean, they actually had a term for it. They called it delivering sailboat fuel, which is,
Air.
Funny, I guess, if you're them. But, there's another company called Custer Battles where these guys had so much money. They were playing football with stacks of $100 bills in their office.
Literally?
Literally. They were literally playing football with stacks of $100 bills.
Remember when, I've forgotten now how much money it was, something like $620 million that was sent to Iraq that just disappeared. Now I'm starting to see. It was more than that. I'm starting to see how it could happen.
Yeah, they sent over $12 billion in cash at the beginning of the war. There was so much cash that they had to transport it in a C-130 airplane. So they had basically, they sent this gigantic airplane. I mean, if you ever seen a C-130, I mean, it's bigger than the spaceship. This thing, and it was just full of pallet after pallet, stacked to the roof with money.
You mean like $100 bills?
Yeah, exactly. So you had $12 billion in cash that they brought to a war zone, and whenever L. Paul Bremer, who was the viceroy of Iraq at the time, felt like he needed to pay somebody for anything, they would basically just reach into the kitty and send a bunch of soldiers in a Humvee to pay people, out of bags of cash. And there were instances where a single soldier would be sitting guarding $200 or $300 million in cash, just sitting there in a locker. And there were, he would testify later that he would get up at lunch hour and leave it alone. I mean, this money went completely unaccounted for. I think they ended up having over $8.5 billion of that original $12 billion go missing.
Why would anybody send several billion dollars in cash to a war zone?
Well, the rationale for sending that much cash to a war zone is that because it was a war zone and there was no infrastructure to deliver money in any other way, they had to use cash, which on some level, I guess, makes some kind of sense. But, it's certainly not a responsible way to do business, and it certainly didn't encourage any of these guys to behave responsibly with the money. I mean, if $8.5 billion goes missing, you can be certain that It wasn't all accidentally misplaced or lost in the couch pillows. I mean, there's plenty of evidence that this money was stolen.
If you were a conspiracy theorist, you know, you could say, put these two facts together that we've talked about, the fact that in the presidential campaign, we've got candidates who are talking in incredible generalities, you know, using words like strengths and courage and values and get rid of special interests. And on the other hand, you have these really sort of dynamite stories, which are never referred to. I mean, it's kind of hard not to put those two things together and wonder just how much we're being lied to all the time.
You can put a third thing together and note that the candidate who's taking the most money from defense contractors in this race isn't a Republican. It's Hillary Clinton. And Barack Obama's not far behind. So, you know, it's something that voters should definitely consider when they listen to these people. I mean, you know, government is complicated. It's corrupt. There's a lot that goes on that's unsavory. And we send them an awful lot of money every year. And a lot of it goes missing or it goes to programs that aren't deserving or are wasteful. And when these politicians come back to us in a campaign year and they don't talk about anything at all, well, what does that tell you? I mean, you're exactly right. It tells you that they're not telling us what's happening, you know, with our money and with the inner workings of government.
Well, Matt, it's been really depressing talking with you.
Anytime.
Thanks.
Thanks very much.
Okay, I'm going to go home and slip my wrists now.
Okay.
Okay. Take care. Have fun on the campaign trail.
Matt Taibbi is a contributing editor for Rolling Stone magazine. He's also the author of the book Smells Like Dead Elephants, Dispatches from a Rotting Empire. Anne Strange Champ spoke with him.